This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory, which is a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Emily Erickson, who is Associate Professor of Sociology at Yale and the Academic Director of the Fox International Fellowship. We're going to be talking about her new book, Trade and Nation, How Companies and Politics Reshaped Economic Thought. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
This is a fascinating book. It was one of my summer reading books. It does so many things at once, actually, that I kind of hope we get to do justice to all of the different elements and different kind of facets of the book over the course of our discussion. And there's stuff going on about economics, history of economics. There's stuff that is, you know, about the kind of appropriate methods in sociology, so some really, really interesting methodological innovations. But also actually there's, I guess, a kind of story that you're trying to tell with the book that's about kind of social, political and economic change as much as it is about the kind of theories and ideas that are going on with economics. So maybe we'll start with two things. The first thing is, what actually got you interested in writing about the history of economics and I guess the kind of history of economic theory?
Well, so it took a little while, actually. I mean, I'm an economic sociologist, but I didn't really start there. I actually started as an undergraduate in history at UC Berkeley. I took a seminar, and one of the books we read was Islands of History by Marshall Solans. And I just sort of fell in love with that. I mean, it kind of drew me from, you know, it's a combination of history and anthropology, social science. It kind of drew me from history into sociology, and it's about the encounters between Europeans and Polynesian, Melanesian islanders. And they meet, and there's this incredible transformation of the social structure of both societies. So I was drawn to this era, the early modern era, and I was interested in looking at encounters between societies. And that led me to study the English East India Company. And while I was doing research and working on the English East India Company, which there I have another earlier book on that company, I noticed something that I thought was really sort of odd, which is that almost all of the extremely important economic texts from the 17th century are written by the owners of these companies, these large overseas trading companies. And that just seemed pretty notable to me. And I wondered what the connection was. And that's really what drew me into the topic.
It's probably worth actually introducing it's wrong to call them the kind of heroes of the story. That's not at all the kind of appropriate language. But the writers of these texts are a really kind of fascinating group, and you've alluded to them as a kind of group that often owns key companies that are about to benefit from from particular political changes, but also, you know, benefiting from the, some of the economic theories they're putting forward. But this kind of, I guess, sort of merchant class that you're interested in, who are they and why are they important to the story?
Yeah, well, so the, I mean, the book covers a large range. So it's 1550 to 1720. So there's a lot of different people. But the merchant authors were often, but not always, the owners or principal investors in a large monopoly overseas trading companies, which was sort of the way that large scale or large scale trade was conducted, was through companies that were constituted as monopolies, the exclusive rights to specific areas of trade. But the actual people, there are some people that really stand out as being kind of more important, having more influence. And so there's a couple of debates that seem to be more prominent and had more influence over time. The first one was this really interesting bullionist debate. And here we have three figures that are important and sort of probably give a better sense of what type of people were engaged in this kind of publishing at the time. And there's Gerard de Molaines, who is a master of the mint, very much sort of an elite intellectual there, but also engaged in commercial pursuits. But he's much closer to the government, sort of or the state, a little bit more of a kind of an old school for the time approach to economic theory. And really sort of a bullionist. I mean, sort of unsurprisingly, he's making his living or making revenue from the mint, and he's focused on clipping, just, you know, cutting down coins in that people, they cut off the edges of coins in order to get money and accumulate wealth. And that he thought this was a really pernicious activity. Was certainly illegal, but he thought it also did a lot to depress trade. But he was on one side, and on the other side of this was a man named Thomas Munn, who was one of the principals of the English East India Company, and another man named Edward Misselden, who was he was in the merchant adventures, but he actually really wanted to get into the English East India Company and get stock there. And they took a different side. And unsurprisingly, the side that they took was less of a bullionist position. He was saying that it wasn't the amount of bullion in the kingdom that determined the wealth of and prosperity of the nation, which was the position Edward Misselden was taking. They instead said that it was the amount of trade. And that really worked for them because the English East India Company had to export bullion to other countries in order to purchase the cottons and the spices that they made their profits from.
Early on in the book, I mean, you've captured that debate so well. And early on in the book, you kind of lay out the way that debate got pretty kind of vicious in terms of the kind of, I guess, economic theoretical, but also kind of, you know, quite practical economic conflicts. And I'm glad you mentioned the East India Company, because in the first first third of the book, that's really one of the kind of key institutions. And you mentioned its trading role, but I wonder if you could sort of introduce it a little bit more to the reader. You know, you mentioned things like having monopolies on trade in particular areas. And why was it so central, I guess, both in terms of what it actually did, but also in terms of how its practices were theorized by some of the authors you're interested in?
Well, the English East India Company was a huge company. And this is in an era where companies were a novel invention. So trade and commerce for most of human history was organized at the scale of maybe partnerships or individual merchants. This is something that was really different about what was going on in Europe, was that trade began to be organized in terms of these large bodies of individuals. And the English East India Company was one of the largest of this new mode, this new way of organizing trade that had entirely different capacities than say a partnership or an individual might have, right? I mean, to be honest, I think that the companies, the rise of the companies is one of the things that sort of changed the trajectory of European history and made it seem so different from the trajectory or what was going on in other parts of the world. So the English East India Company is really important just because it's one of these new companies, but it was also incredibly profitable for the people that were engaged in this trade. They really made a killing bringing in goods that were relatively common in the sort of in the Indonesian archipelago or and the Indian subcontinent, and the spices, the cottons, coffee, you know, things that if you thought of your life without these goods, it would be greatly impoverished. I mean, it was very hard to think of not having ceramics, not having cotton to clothing. All of these things, they were just incredibly popular in Europe. And so the East India Company made lots of money. And in order to do so, it's kind of challenged some assumptions about how wealth was constructed. I would say it kind of opened up the possibility of seeing how expansion of trade could lead to national economic development. I mean, you see these things happening, but it challenged the assumption that at the time that the way that you build wealth was by accumulating more gold. And, you know, so, I mean, it's kind of like very interesting question about how, where does value reside? And it wasn't, well, people had different ideas about where value resided at the time. So, and a commonly accepted position was that it had something to do with the intrinsic metallic nature of gold and silver. Most people don't believe that that's true at this point. But because the East India Company exported bullion to Asia in order to get these goods. And by the way, the reason that they exported bullion to Asia was because Asia had no interest in the goods that were being produced in England at the time. It just, they were just sort of inferior in comparison with the quality of the goods in Asia. So they had to produce the one thing that they were interested in from Europe, which was gold and silver. And they had a thriving trade, but that was different than the expectations that people had then, which was what you needed in order to have a thriving trade was to accumulate more and more gold and silver. So I would say that's just that part of the equation is in some sense kind of just a historical accident that it happened to be that the East India Company had to pursue trade in such a way that sort of fundamentally questioned kind of assumptions about prevailing ideas of the value of metals.
If that's one of the key institutional players, and you'd mentioned the debates with the kind of late medievalists and the new emerging mercantilists earlier, who was actually kind of what's the word, consuming these debates? Who was the kind of audience? Who was it that was thinking about, you know, the East India Company as an important institution for growing national wealth and, you know, thinking in terms of producing gold and silver to exchange for, as you say, you know, everyday basics that we think of as coffee, ceramics, etc. Although, you know, were quite luxury goods back then. Yeah, who was the kind of audience for these debates?
Well, the audience for the works was very much the government actors, state actors. So maybe the Privy Council, the Parliament, the Crown. These are the people that are making decisions about, in particular, whether or not to extend monopoly privilege to these companies. So the companies, they depended on, or they certainly thought of themselves as depending upon the monopoly privileges in order to make the highest profits possible. And they depended upon the government to ensure those privileges. So when people made arguments about whether or not the English East India Company deserved its monopoly, they were addressing the Privy Council at the early part of the century and the later part of the century, the Parliament, in order to sort of try to persuade them to take a position on that. So the people in the English East India Company, of course, they want their monopoly privileges extended. So they're making all the arguments that they can about how the export of bullion is actually beneficial to the government in some way because, you know, it increases overseas tax revenue. And the people that are outside of the company are saying, no, they're destroying the nation. They're destroying, you know, that is draining wealth away. And they don't want the privileges to be continued. So, and often, in fact, it's not really an argument between people that believe in monopoly or not, but people that want the privileges for themselves. But when they make those arguments, they're making them to the state.
What you've described so far in terms of institutions, audiences, and writers kind of sounds like a sort of conventional book. It's the kind of, you know, history of economic thought that almost you'd sort of expect to read. But one of the elements that goes beyond just your intriguing thesis about the role of the kind of commercial merchant class in being economic philosophers is also your methods. And I wonder if you could kind of introduce, I suppose, the sort of computational approach that you take, and maybe we'll get into some examples. I mean, it's tricky because there are lots of kind of really wonderful and fascinating things like illustrations in the book, but maybe we'll get into some examples of the computational approach. But before we do that, it'd be good to hear about your methods for the book.
Sure. I really wanted to think, I mean, and partly this is my commitment to sociology as a discipline, as I wanted to not just think about a few important individuals or a few unique texts. I wanted to think about a sort of a cultural shift the way it spread across the entire literature. So I'm assuming and certainly come to the material thinking that, you know, it's not just this one moment of genius that transforms a sort of way of thinking about things. Instead, it's an entire sort of an entire literature. You know, it's the good thinkers, the amazing, brilliant thinkers, and the somewhat more mediocre thinkers. It's all of the sort of the entire population. If we're going to see a cultural shift, it has to be not just what one person thinks, but what becomes commonly accepted among all of the people that are sort of participating in the discourse. So the hard part about thinking about the literature more systematically and trying to include as much as possible in order to see these kind of broad changes in discourse is, of course, that, you know, you have to read quite a lot of books. And sometimes the literature is too large for any one person to be able to read all of the books in their own lifetime, or at least in some kind of reasonable amount of time. So, in the early modern era, there's not as many books as there are now, so it's more possible, but it's still quite a lot of books. So, and it's definitely quite a lot of books to sort of do a kind of a deep reading of and include in an analysis. So what I thought it was really important to do was to bring in some of these newer methods of computational analysis in order to engage in this kind of systematic appraisal of what's going on in the literature and what are the shifts and how did they spread across the entire discourse. So I used topic modeling, which is a way of it's a way of analyzing a large corpus. What it does is sort of inductive. It looks for the co-occurrence of certain words within different segments of text. You don't want to look at co-occurrence of words in a book because that's a lot of co-occurrence, right? So you want to look at how it does it more so like segments of text, like every 500 words or so. And then the words that co-occur frequently become sort of topics, and you can look at their prevalence over time. And that gives you a sort of an idea of what ideas fit together, how they change over time. And you can see certain sort of combinations increase and certain combinations decrease. So, for example, in the book, one of the kind of important topics at the beginning was God, man, honor, I think it was. And that sort of shifts over time. And then trade, nation, and company become more important over the course of the century. And that's not just in these, you know, texts that people look back on, and like Joseph Schumpeter said, oh, this is really important at the time. It's something that happens in a lot of different texts, some that became a little better known, and some that were almost not remarked upon at all.
You mentioned sort of how things spread. And, you know, you'd kind of alluded to in what you'd said there, the sort of the marginality of certain texts and certain words, and the shift from what we think of as the kind of classic set of medieval tropes to a more modern set of economic language. And I was also intrigued by, I think it's the fourth chapter, where you talk about how the merchant authors were also at the center of important networks between, you know, kind of being key players in things like the English East India Company and being related to, you know, bits of government and stuff like this. And I guess if, you know, one element of the computational approach is modeling topics and key themes, the other is thinking about the people involved as well.
Yes, that is true. So the other, it's this, the slightly less novel or slightly less new side of computational methods, which is social network analysis. And social network analysis, I think, is almost absolutely essential, at least bringing that lens to understanding any kind of historical transformation, just because people's relationships are so important, and their relationship to the field of power. These things, they have pretty significant impacts on the kinds of decisions and actions that people take over time. And social network analysis helps you sort of lay that out and in a sense kind of quantify it. And again, allowing you to think about it not just as one person's position, but, you know, the positions of a population of people with respect to each other and different sort of locuses of power in society. So in this case, it matters quite a lot that the merchants that are writing the texts, they tend to be pretty central to the commercial world, commercial relationships, and the kind of network structure of that economic sphere. But they tend to be pretty marginal in the networks of political power. So there's lots of different trade committees that are formed over time. And I look at how the merchants fit into the networks of individuals serving on these different trade committees and councils. And they are really very much at the margins. And they complained about it quite a lot as well. But the interesting thing is their marginality in the world of the state turned out to be really important for the larger story, because they were marginal, they were trying to bridge this gulf to the individuals that actually held the power over commercial policy and that granting of these different monopoly privileges. So they have to kind of, you know, they're sort of like shouting to get the attention of the elites that are operating within the state, making decisions that are important to their commercial futures. And the way they get their attention, you know, they try different methods. Sometimes they're lobbying the state, but this publication of these economic tracts was a way for them to try to get the attention of these state actors, to convince them to take the actions that they hope they would convince or that they would take.
It's really interesting because one sort of reading of this, the use of economic theory to kind of persuade and I guess kind of pay off in terms of, you know, material interests being served, is that, you know, we've got a story of a unique combination of theory, philosophy, and then material interests and individual authors. But one of the things that really intrigued me, and this, you know, is where the book sort of moves to it to its conclusions was the way that you were really kind of interested in like checking your hypothesis. It wasn't just that you told this story of the importance of the merchants as kind of writers, as emerging economists, but actually you try and systematically think through what are the other explanations that there could be for the shift from a medieval to an early modern type of economics and economic theory. And I wonder if you could just pick out a couple of those. You mentioned things like, you know, the transformations of the state. So, you know, where you were talking about kind of marginality of particular authors, you know, maybe it's that, you know, states are growing and that drives the changes in economic theory. Or, you know, is it the fact that you get the emergence of a kind of what we'd recognize as a civil society, you know, these sorts of things, of things that you mentioned. So yeah, how did you sort of test your hypothesis about the merchant economic theorists?
Well, I mean, I did. So it's true. I tried to include different types of tests in different chapters. And the truth is, I mean, I think it was really important to evaluate these alternative hypotheses. My first guess about what was driving this transformation was that it was the expansion of overseas trade. So I thought, and many people in the past have also thought that, as trade expands, it just becomes logistically kind of more difficult and you need to kind of invent new ways of thinking about it to manage all of the resulting complexities. But I found pretty quickly that's almost certainly wasn't the case. So I did want to evaluate the sort of standing theories that have been posed, like economic development, like the growth of the nation state, the growth of the civil sphere. So what I did, what I actually fitted into a regression, a time series regression, where I'm looking at, which is a good way of ruling out alternative hypotheses. I'm looking at when the articles are published, how many articles on trade are published in a year, and what in the previous year, because it takes a little bit of time for publication, you know, were there increases or decreases in state capacity? Were there increases or decreases in economic growth? Were there increases or decreases in commercial development? So then I look at this over time. What's the association between these different sort of events and then rates of publication? But I also do it cross-sectionally with a comparative approach that looks at what was occurring in the Netherlands versus England.
Yeah, that comparison with the Netherlands, I thought was particularly kind of insightful because it's almost as if you kind of, you know, you've engaged with, I guess, you know, the kind of existing literature and thought through your hypothesis. But that, you know, really obvious kind of provocative question about, well, why did it happen in England? And maybe as we kind of conclude, maybe you could say a bit about, well, why did it happen in England? Why? What would the Netherlands, you know, they just didn't have the kind of the right sort of merchant writers. You know, there was a different kind of state configuration. There were, you know, less sort of economic interests driving the writing. What was the story of why we don't have a Dutch tradition of these early economists?
Yeah, there's two central reasons, and they're related. They're certainly causally related. But I mean, the thing about the Dutch Republic, of course, like phenomenally commercially dynamic a place, but it's interesting. There are companies in the Dutch setting, but there's not as many. And the reason that there's not as many is really because the merchants had more control over the government, and the companies tended to exclude merchants. So most merchants aren't in favor of exclusive monopoly privileges. But that's sort of a clue as to really what the kind of pivotal reason is, and it's that in the Dutch Republic, merchants were essentially in control. They were in control of Amsterdam, which was the most powerful of the different sections of the Estates General. So they they had no need. So if you can imagine, in the context of England, the merchants are trying to get the attention of state actors. In the context of the Dutch Republic, they're in the government. They have no need to make, they don't need to make appeals to a public in order to persuade state actors. They're already there on the floor. Their arguments can be made within the halls of government itself. So this intermediate step of publishing in the public sphere, which was actually ultimately very important towards the sort of flourishing of this style of economic thought, it just doesn't happen in there, happen in the context of the Dutch case.
I think I've said this sort of several times throughout our conversation that, you know, that this story that you tell is not just kind of fascinating, but also it allows you to kind of weave in these, you know, really interesting and actually really important reflections on things like methods and, you know, various, I suppose, you know, new and emerging. It's funny you mentioned stuff like social network analysis as being like, you know, yeah, this is kind of standard and boring for sociologists, but actually in the context of a book about economic theory and economic history, I found it really, really kind of refreshing and really interesting. And I wonder, to what extent do you think there are sort of maybe lessons is the wrong word, but, you know, sort of possibilities that are opened up in terms of what historians, economists, and sociologists might get from your book?
Well, I do think that, you know, a systematic appraisal of these different moments. I mean, I would say, you know, changes in culture, those are broad changes that they have to take place across the entire population. I mean, the populations create cultures, not just individuals. So I think using the kinds of tools that allow us to think about the choices and beliefs of a large population of individuals, they are really important. And to do that, you know, we our brains are only capable of so much. I think we need some computational assistance usually to think about it, a large number of individuals at one time making sort of complicated decisions. So I really do think that things like topic modeling and definitely network analysis are just so important to understanding institutional and cultural change over time. And those are things that really matter. They don't just matter in terms of understanding the past, they matter in terms of understanding where we're going in the future and how to make society a better place for everyone that inhabits it. So, I mean, generally that's one point. The other point though, that I would like to say is, you know, this is about a sort of a shift in the way people thought about economics. And what's kind of interesting to me is, it's a historically contingent shift from thinking about exchange in terms of whether it's fair and beneficial for people, into thinking about exchange and commerce in terms of its effect on a national economic growth and sort of, you know, its impact on sort of state capacity, really. But I think hopefully that by showing, like situating the historical nature of that transformation, that it might make it possible to kind of rethink how we think about capitalism and economics and kind of create a little bit more space to think about the ethics of commercial exchange and bring a little bit more equity and fairness into how we evaluate patterns of economic activity, sort of a moral capitalism approach.
I mean, but both parts of your answer there in terms of a kind of understanding and, you know, possibly changing the world, and then your latter point about, I guess, kind of better understanding of things like the economic sociology of capitalism, they sound like pretty big agendas. So are you going to be working on, you know, kind of similar related things? You mentioned your previous work, you know, and the way that trading nation had kind of developed from that. And actually reading it, you know, there are definitely quite a few possible new agendas that spring from it. Or is it time for something completely different?
Well, no, I think not completely different. I think not completely different, but maybe a little bit more recent is possible. So what I've been thinking about most recently is the division of labor and the division of labor's impact on society, and also on what conditions under which the division of labor is more easily achieved. And what it's led me to in terms of another long-term project is I'm actually really interested in forms of corporate organization and the way that they relate to the sort of democratic project or democratization over time. I think it's a little bit more of a complex relationship than people have found up to this point. So, I mean, in the early modern period, you see that the emergence of these companies, you know, it goes right along with the transformation of society into a more democratic state. And I know I'm just at the very beginning stages of this, but I think it's an important thing to look at. And I think it'll be interesting.